Okay, so this is Bio 231, November 12th, and I'm looking at the schedule right here, and we're scheduled to have a test a week from today, because today's Wednesday. All right, and the things that will be on the test, let's see if we can figure this out. It's going to go through heart, so I'm going to start talking about the heart today and next time, and we're going to finish up special senses today. So it's going to be on... Let's see. Did we have central nervous system on the last test? I don't believe so. Okay, so it's going to start with central nervous system, peripheral nervous system, autonomic nervous system, special senses, and heart on the next test. Okay, that's a week. Now, that central nervous system chapter kind of meanders around, talks about a lot of different things in that chapter, and what you really want to focus on are the things that I presented to you in lecture. So focus on the lecture notes, the exam figures, of course, and then any of the web materials that I have or the end of chapter questions that I have for you to review. Those are the things that you should key on for every chapter, not just central nervous system, but probably especially the central nervous system. The chapter is well written. If you need to go back and read stuff, that's great, but you don't have to just sit there and memorize every page in the central nervous system chapter, okay? All right, so are there any questions for that test coming up a week from today? No? Yes? Okay, they're on my Cypress College website, and I think I have, let's see if I have internet connection right here. Open? No, I don't, but I'm going to click that open. And I believe they're all there. I uploaded them. So if you want to go back and listen to the lectures again, that's excellent. Some students find it helpful. Other students don't find it so helpful, so you just got to try for yourself. See how that goes. All right, so this is my homepage. It is http://SEM. That stands for Science Engineering Math. Cypress College, that stands for here, .edu, and then slash, and that's a tilde, J. Gober. And that takes you to this homepage. These are all the classes that I teach. So what are you interested in? You're interested in Bio 231 lecture. So we have to click on the left-hand frame 231 lecture. That takes you to this page. And then the lectures are under the course links on the right-hand side of the page. Lectures. And here are all the lectures from the beginning of the class. All right, so here's the senses lecture, this is the audio tape, and then this is a transcript of it, so that if somebody has a hearing deficit, they can read the material that was presented in lecture. All right, so that's there for you to look at. Okay. All right, the WAV files are from the actual lecture that I gave in class. The transcripts are from a previous semester. So it's not exactly 100%. The dates are definitely going to be wrong because it's from a different semester, but the content will be the same. All right. So the audio tapes are what I explained in class this semester, but the transcripts are from a different semester altogether. And on Blackboard, I believe I sent an email with this link. So if you look in your announcements on Blackboard, you can always find this link to these lectures. Okay. So if you get lost finding it, look on Blackboard. All right, so we're going to move on to hearing today. Actually, we've got three more special senses to appreciate, and these are associated with the ear. Okay, there are three senses involving the ear. They are hearing, and then two kinds of equilibrium, two ways that your body can maintain equilibrium. One is called static equilibrium, and the other is called dynamic or kinetic equilibrium. So let's look at some of these structures associated with these senses. So here we just have a nice section of the whole ear, and we got to break the ear down into three main parts. You have an internal ear, a middle ear, and an external. The external starts right here at the pinna. Sometimes we call this the auricle. It's just a flap of skin, has cartilage in there that helps funnel sound, keeps debris out of the external acoustic meatus or external auditory meatus, which takes sound pressure deep inside your head, right? But it's doesn't continue on to the brain. It's blocked by a number of things. All right, so this is the external ear from the tympanic membrane all the way to the outside world. That's the external ear. You have some sweat glands in there that have been modified to secrete a oily, waxy material we call cerumen, and that helps lubricate the tympanic membrane because the tympanic membrane has to vibrate back and forth all the time when sound energy bounces upon it. All right, so between the tympanic membrane and to this place right here, which is what we call the oval window, this is the middle ear. And in the middle ear, we have some bones. We have three bones, the malleus, incus, and stapes. And you can see that the stapes looks like a stirrup. That's how it was named. So the bones were named after real-world objects that they sort of look like. But, of course, nobody or nothing ever puts their foot in the stirrup. That just happens to be the shape of this particular bone, right? Okay. But notice the shape. Does it, when it touches the vestibule, which is this part right here, does that shape look more oval or round to you? The footprint of the stapes. Okay. Well. Okay. All right. So this is just a hole. This is a foramen in the bone. But I'm talking about the base of this bone right here. Does this look round or oval? And I want you to appreciate it that it should look oval because underneath the stapes is another membrane, and that membrane we call the oval window. All right, so here's that stapes. If we look from the top down, the stapes kind of looks like this. Here's the base. But if we look at the base this way, this is what the base of the stapes looks like, right? It certainly is not round like that. Okay. All right, so from the tympanic membrane to the oval window right here, that's the middle ear containing these bones, which we call auditory ossicles. There are some muscles that can adjust the vibration, the amplitude of vibration transmitted by these bones. And, so there's some muscles that attach to these bones as well. And let's see. This tympanic membrane should be right at atmospheric pressure, whatever the pressure is in the room. It shouldn't be high or low, because if the pressure on the outside of the ear is greater than this middle compartment, then the tympanic membrane is going to be pushed into the middle compartment right here, and it eventually might rupture as well. All right, and if it gets pushed all the way to the end, then the tympanic membrane can't vibrate. The only way that it can vibrate back and forth is if the pressure in the middle compartment and the outer ear is exactly the same. Then it's going to vibrate back and forth very nicely. And then you'll be able to hear those sounds. Yeah?
Just curious, but you know how there's certain times, like, on your ears, sometimes you hear like a certain screech or like a lung?
I'm not familiar with the screech or the lung thing that you hear.
I don't know how to describe it, though, but like, is that just
I'm not sure. Maybe see me after class. Okay, there's a ringing that we call tinnitus, but the screeching kind of thing. All right, there are a lot of times we don't know what causes tinnitus. And so since we don't know what causes it, sometimes we don't know how to treat it very effectively either. Okay, and it can be a persistent problem in some people when they hear these noises and there's no sound in space. Yeah. Okay, so this is the middle ear. And the way that the pressure is equalized between the outside world and the middle ear compartment is that there's a tube that goes from the middle ear all the way down to your throat. And we call that the Eustachian tube. Or sometimes we call it the auditory tube. And sometimes we call it the pharyngotympanic tube. So it goes by a bunch of different names. All right, you probably haven't heard of the pharynx yet, but the pharynx is just a fancy name for your throat. So when you get a sore throat, what do we call that? That's a pharyngitis, right? Okay, so pharynx is just your throat. This tube goes down to your throat to equalize the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane so that it can vibrate back and forth. You shouldn't have fluid in this compartment. You shouldn't have blood or pus or anything like that because that's going to inhibit the vibration of this tympanic membrane. When the tympanic membrane vibrates, it vibrates the auditory ossicles and the stapes and vibrates the oval window. And that's what introduces sound pressure into the inner ear. The inner ear has three components to it. It's got the vestibule, which is about in this region right here, the three semicircular canals, and the structure that kind of looks like a snail. That's what we call the cochlea. So we have these three bony labyrinths, the cochlea, the vestibule, and semicircular canals, and those are what provide the sight for those three senses that we were talking about, namely hearing, static equilibrium, and kinetic equilibrium. Yeah?
Are there glands?
Oh, over here. They're over here. They're in the external auditory canal. They're not on the inside. They're not on the. They're not in the middle ear at all.
So what's that layer between the inner ear and the
outer ear? The inner and middle. You mean like right here?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there's a bony labyrinth made up of these structures, the vestibule and the cochlea and the semicircular canals. And the separation, there is just a membrane that we call the oval window. Okay, so sound really doesn't travel very well through the bone, but it mostly enters the cochlea. This is the place for hearing through the oval window. Okay, so I'm sure there probably are some, maybe some mucus glands or something. They don't secrete a lot because that would plug up this middle ear chamber. But if somebody has an infection, then of course that part gets plugged up and you have a hearing loss as a result of that. And typically little kids get that middle ear infection. We call that otitis media. Otitis media. Okay, yeah.
So you said that the vestibule?
Vestibule.
Equilibrium?
Yeah, I'm going to go over that a bunch of times because I got to describe what's inside here. I'm just giving you an overall view of the ear, namely what? The external ear, the middle ear, and the internal. Okay. So let's see, where are we? Oracle. Yeah, we talked about all these. The muscles that control the vibrations in the auditory ossicle are called the tensor tympani and the stapedius. So for instance, when you're driving down the freeway with your windows open and it's really loud outside, what do you do to the radio in your car? You turn it up. And you turn it up. And so what does your middle ear do? Those muscles contract a little bit, protect your ear from those loud sounds, right? And then what do you do to the radio? Turn it up even more, right? And then you park, and you go home, and the next morning you get into the car and turn the engine on, and what's the stereo doing? What's the sound like? Oh, it's like blasting. It's like your wild nephew borrowed your car overnight or something, right? But that's just what? How your ears accommodate or adapt to sound pressure, trying to protect your inner ear. Yeah, was there a question someplace? Yeah, yeah. Tell me.
You know how, like, when people are driving on the freeway, they have the window down?
Yeah?
You know how the people, it's kind of like, there's like a vibration feeling that's like...
Yeah, like a whoop, 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 whoop. That's just pressure inside the car as you're driving, coming through the window. And you can feel it, and some people can actually hear that. Okay. So let's talk about hearing first, the special sense for hearing. Your book doesn't talk about it first, but I'm going to talk about it first. All right, so here are the three parts of the inner ear, namely the cochlea, the vestibule, and the semicircular canals, and there are things inside these structures. All right, so let's look at the structures for hearing. All right, so the cochlea, if we make a nice cross-section through the cochlea, that snail-shaped object, this is what it looks like on the inside. We have three chambers filled with fluid, and it's the job of the auditory ossicles to take sound, which is a mechanical wave, and put it into the fluid inside the ear. And that's actually very difficult to do. If you've ever been swimming, for instance, and talking to somebody that's sitting on a lawn chair outside the pool, and you're in the pool, and then you put your head underwater, what happens to the conversation? Can you hear the person that's out of the water? You know you can't, because sound doesn't like to jump into fluid very much. All right, so that's the job of the tympanic membrane and the auditory ossicles. I guess I'm going to have to go back to show you. All right, sorry about that. Here's a good slide for you to see that. So the arrangement of these bones and the large surface area of the tympanic membrane is producing a large sound on this smaller membrane that we call the oval window. So that sound energy can actually enter the fluid in the inner ear. All right, so that's the job of these two membranes and the auditory ossicles. And the sound, and so here is the cochlea, looks like a snail. And the cochlea actually reminds me of a piano. What does a piano look like? How does a piano make noise? Or music? Or sound? Yeah, there are strings, right? And if you hit one of the strings, it will vibrate at a characteristic frequency. Some strings produce low frequencies, some produce high frequencies. What kind of strings produce low frequencies? Anybody look ever inside a piano? The long, thick strings vibrate very slowly, and the very thin, short strings vibrate at a very high frequency. And those sound like different pitches, okay, in our temporal lobe. So we appreciate sound in our temporal lobe. So there are things inside the cochlea that resemble a piano. There are some very thick, long regions, and then there are some thin regions. The thin regions in the cochlea vibrate very fast. Those send signals to the brain, signifying a high frequency. There are other very long structures in the cochlea that vibrate at only low frequencies. So actually, what you have inside your middle, your inner ear on both sides is a piano. Okay, you have two pianos in there. But we kind of look silly with pianos sticking out of the sides of our head. So what has happened through evolution? The pianos have been rolled up, right, to fit into a small space. But if we really wanted to look at a cochlea to see how it looked at like a piano, we could do what? So here's the cochlea. We could just unroll it. And we would see at the end over here, these are for stimulating low frequencies. And over here by the oval window, this is what stimulates high frequency hearing. And in the middle, what do you have in the middle? Like middle frequencies or mid-range frequencies. All right, so we would call these mid-range frequencies right here. Okay, so sound comes in to a chamber, which we call the scala vestibuli, okay, which is connected to the oval window right here. It moves through another chamber, and there's a special organ right here for hearing. And then finally, so the sound comes in, and the sound leaves through the scala tympani right over here, and it leaves the cochlea. So the bony labyrinth right here is the cochlea. Sound leaves through another membrane into the middle ear. And this one here is what we call the round window. So high frequencies will go across the middle compartment over here, and low frequencies are going to go more to the end. The end of the cochlea is called the helicotrema. All right, and then leave. So the job of the round window right here is to prevent the cochlea from shattering or from destroying, because what is the stapes doing? The stapes is connected to the oval window right here, and what's it doing? It's punching the oval window, so it's injecting energy into the cochlea, and if it had no place to go, then this cochlea eventually would just break down because of that vibration. But it's a job of the round window, so when the sound energy enters the scala tympani, the round window vibrates and it releases the energy that was injected into your middle ear. All right, so let's take a look at, if we just make a cross section through the cochlea, let's look at those ducts. Okay, and the ducts are right here. So here's the scala vestibuli. This is the fluid compartment that is connected up to the oval window. Here's the scala media, sometimes we call this the cochlear duct, there's some more fluid in here, and here's the scala tympani, which is connected up to the round window. This is how sound can escape. So sound energy is going to move from the vestibuli, scala vestibuli, into the tympani, going across, all right, this structure right here inside the cochlea. And this structure is what we call the organ of Corti. The organ of Corti is composed of a couple of different membranes. This membrane right here is called the tectorial membrane. And when sound moves from the vestibuli into the tympani, guess what happens to this membrane right here?
It vibrates,
okay? By frequency, depending on exactly where in the cochlea that part of the tectorial membrane is. Remember, high frequency, down over here by the oval window, low frequencies out by the helicotrema. And can you see anything connected to that tectorial membrane? Look, there are some sensory receptor cells right here that have something that looks like cilia on the apical surface right here that are connected to the tectorial membrane. So when the tectorial membrane vibrates, it bends these cilia. And somebody looked at this one time and said, well, those kind of look like hairs, so guess what? We're going to call these cells right here. We're going to call these hair cells. Are they producing hair? No. They're microscopic, all right? They have these cilia on them. And when the cilia bend, it sends electrical signals into the cochlear nerve, which goes to your brain, and it gives you the perception of sound. So the hair cell is the receptor cell for sound in the organ of Corti. Right, and what bony structure do we find the organ of Corti at? Right, it's within this middle chamber of what is this bony structure called? It looks like the snail. It's the cochlea, right? It's the cochlea. So the cochlea is the bony labyrinth. The organ that allows you to hear is called the organ of Corti, and the specific cells that allow you to hear are hair cells, which sounds a little funny. Okay, so there's also a basilar membrane right here that doesn't vibrate. It's the tectorial membrane here that vibrates these little hair cells or the cilia on these hair cells that send action potentials to the brain for your appreciation of sound. So probably you should know scala vestibuli, scala media, scala tympani, and which window they're connected up to. Huh? Yeah, the round window is the tympani right here. That's how sound escapes. Sound gets into the organ of Corti via the scala vestibuli. And just by the shape of the cochlea, different parts will vibrate at different frequencies, just like a piano. Okay, and that goes to different parts of your brain, on the surface of your brain. And actually, you have like two pianos in your temporal lobes that will depolarize depending on the frequency. Okay, yeah, question.
There's a question in the notes that what can vibrate baseline membrane proximal
to. Okay, let's go. So these notes right here?
Yes.
Okay, so I have a question someplace. Usually I like to put it in italics so I can see it. Here, sound vibrations from the scala vestibuli. Basilar membrane distal to the oval window is wide and flexible. Okay, what tones vibrate them? All right, so here is the oval window. What do we call this section of the cochlea that's very close to the oval window? Is that going to be a proximal section or a distal section? That's proximal. All right, so this is a proximal section. The helicotrema is the farthest away. That's what we call the distal. All right, so the more proximal are going to be high frequencies, and the more distal regions are low frequencies, and in between are middle type frequencies. All right, well, when we say frequencies, we have to be talking about a wave. So here's a wave going up and down. Sound kind of looks like that if we were to measure the pressure. And this distance here represents the amplitude or the loudness that we would appreciate. All right, and the distance from here to here determines the frequency of this particular wave. All right, so this is one kind of frequency as opposed to, I'm going to draw it down over here, this kind of frequency. This is a wave as well. So we got A and B. Which one is a higher frequency? You know what? It's this one because you have more waves per time. All right, so this axis right here that I'm drawing, this is time. Okay, so the amplitude kind of looks the same, right? But the frequency is different. So this is low frequency, this is high frequency. This kind over here vibrates the more distal regions of the organ of Corti, and the high frequencies vibrate the more proximal regions. Yeah. Yes, it certainly does. And also, if you apply very high amplitude signals to the ear, it will damage the organ of Corti as well. Okay, and typically the kind of energy that is most damaging to the ear is higher frequency, not lower frequency type information. So when somebody has a hearing deficit, they maybe can hear low frequencies, but they can't hear high frequencies very well. So when they listen to somebody speak, what did I just tell you? Who knows? So it's really unfortunate. You can tell somebody's talking to you, but you can't really appreciate what they're saying because it's all muddled sounding. And so when somebody gets a hearing aid, right, that amplifies certain sounds, we don't amplify low frequencies, right? You have to amplify high frequencies to bring their hearing back into balance. And so it takes a specialist to know how to balance those frequencies out so that it sound normal to you. Okay? All right, so I like that question. Let me just make sure I see. Yeah, proximal and distal. So both of those we kind of answered, right? So the helicotrema region is low frequency. Closer to the oval window is high frequency. Yeah. Smell can to some degree, okay. As far as equilibrium and hearing, I don't believe so. Maybe taste to some degree. A smell, because there are stem cells, right, that replace the olfactory nerves. I don't know of any places on the tongue or taste buds that have stem cells, but they probably have a limited life as well and can be replaced, okay, as long as there's not too much damage to that tissue. But vision, no. Hearing, no. Equilibrium, no. Okay, for the special senses. Okay, so that's pretty much for hearing. Let's talk about static equilibrium. So static equilibrium involves the vestibule right here. There are two organs, and the two organs are called the utricle and saccule. Both of these are what we call maculae. So there are spaces in the vestibule right here. And in the whole inner ear, remember, there is fluid. All right, so here is a nice picture. Here we see the cochlea. Here is the vestibule and the maculae for both the utricle and saccule. Well, the maculae is made up of, oh, like an epithelium right here with some special cells, some receptor cells. And on the top of these receptor cells, we see some more cilia poking off of them. So we call these stereocilia. And they're poking up into a gelatinous mass, something that's very jello-like that is sitting in the maculae. And on top of this gelatinous mass, there are some additional weights. There are crystals of calcium carbonate, and we call these otoliths. So anytime we are talking about something that has to do with the ear, we like to use that term odo, as opposed, so the instrument that we use to look in somebody's ear, that's called an otoscope, right, O-T-O. All right, so gravity is going to have an effect on this gelatinous mass as well as these crystals. So in our ears, we have these little crystals, probably fairly microscopic. I don't think you could really appreciate them with your naked eye, but with a microscope, you can see them. All right, so gravity is always going to be pulling down on them, whatever way gravity is, depending on what position your head is in. So if you're standing upright with your facing forward, right, the gravity is pulling straight down on these otoliths and the gelatinous mass, and the stereocilia here do not bend because weight is right on top of them. But as soon as you tilt your head, for instance, forward, guess what happens?
It shifts.
Yeah, the gravity pulls on the otoliths and shifts the gelatinous mass anteriorly, and now that bends these stereocilia, and then they send action potentials to your brain so that you have a sense of head position. All right, so not motion, but just head position, because gravity is always pulling on your head. So let's see. Here is the gelatinous mass is not being deformed, but as you tilt your head forward, that deforms the stereocilia, and it sends action potentials to your brain, giving you the sense that your body position has changed. So we call this static equilibrium. So these cells right here, guess what these cells are called? These are now called hair cells as well. Okay, so this sense is static equilibrium, having to do with the vestibule and the maculae are the organs inside there. The receptor cell is a hair cell for static equilibrium. The last kind of sense that we have in the inner ear, right, has to do with the semicircular canals right here and right here. And there is fluid inside the semicircular canals, just like in the maculae and in the cochlea. All right, and at the base of every semicircular canal, there are three canals, there are three bulges. And a little bulge, it kind of looks like a little vial, another name for a vial, or a little glass tube, sometimes it's called an ampule. So these little things are called the ampullae, and inside the ampullae is the organ responsible for kinetic equilibrium. And the sense of kinetic equilibrium has to do with spinning. Whenever you start spinning or stop spinning, then the semicircular canals give you that sense of acceleration, but not forward or backwards, but what? In a rotational or spinning kind of sense. And you all probably knew this back when you were 2 or 3 years old, or maybe over the weekend, I'm not sure. Maybe some of you even closed your eyes and did what? Spun around. And then stopped all of a sudden, opened your eyes, and what did the world look like? It looked like it was spinning around, okay? And that's because of these semicircular canals and the fluid inside them. All right, so the organ responsible for this sense is what we call the crista ampullaris, because it's inside the ampule. And we see some nerve fibers, we see a nice supporting epithelium, and there is a gelatinous mass in the crista ampullaris, like we saw in the maculae. There are no otoliths on this one, it's just a gelatinous mass. And embedded in this gelatinous mass are stereocilia from these receptor cells. Guess what we call these receptor cells again? They're hair cells. Okay. So this is the crista ampullaris, the cupula, which is a gelatinous mass, the stereocilia coming from hair cells, and when these stereocilia bend, that sets up electrical signals that go through the vestibular nerve to our brain to give us that sense of what, spinning or rotational acceleration. All right, so how does that happen? Well, there's a property of mass called inertia. And inertia just means that if something has mass, it doesn't want to change velocity or change direction. It just likes to sit still. Inertia also means that if you have mass and you're moving someplace, then that mass likes to continue in that direction. It doesn't like to stop, and it certainly doesn't like to change direction very much. So those are the two effects of inertia. So for instance, you should try this Thanksgiving time. Okay, because maybe you're going to have go to some relative's house or have some relatives over to your house, and you're going to have a real fancy table set up, right, with a turkey and wine glasses and candelabras and all that kind of stuff on the table. And what do you put down on the table so the table doesn't get wrecked? Like a tablecloth. So, right, you can just clean that up. So everything's going to be on top of the tablecloth, like what? Wine bottles, champagne, wine glasses, candelabra, stuff like that. And I want you to perform this experiment.
No.
Okay? So inertia means what? This mass, this bottle right here, doesn't want to move, right, if we apply a force to it. All right? So I could pull out the tablecloth and everything, the silverware, the plates, you know, right, the dressing, nothing is going to move, right? So if I do that, because there's inertia in this water bottle right here. So when you start to move, mass likes to stay in one position. All right. The other thing is that once we get, if I do this slowly, I can get the water bottle to move and then I'll stop. If I stop the paper suddenly, what's going to happen to the bottle? It's going to continue to move because of inertia. So if I move it and then stop all of a sudden, oh, you saw the bottle move? That was pretty nice. So that's inertia. All right. So think of the paper as being the crista ampullaris and the fluid in this bottle as the endolymph in the semicircular canals, right? If once we get it moving, it's going to want to keep moving. Or, if it's stationary, it's not going to want to move. But I'll give that bottle back to you. Okay. How is that going to affect the cupula right here? As a matter of fact, the stereocilia. All right, so let me see if I got another picture. Sure. So, for instance, here is somebody with their head still. And if they start to spin, the crista ampullaris is attached to your cranial bone. So the crista ampullaris is going to start spinning. But what about the fluid inside the semicircular canals? It has inertia. It's going to want to stay stationary. But so what happens is then there is a flow that goes over the gelatinous mass or the cupula, bending these stereocilia right here, giving you the sense of acceleration in an angular direction. And you have three of those semicircular canals, so no matter which way you start to spin, right to left or anterior posterior or some other direction, all right, you can figure out which direction you're spinning in. Okay. Now, if you spin for, say, a minute, what happens to the endolymph? Okay, it starts to spin as well. It catches up to your body. And then if you stop, the crista ampullaris stops. What about the endolymph? It's spinning, and it's going to take a little while to stop spinning, so it's going to bend the cupula back the other way. And if you open your eyes, it looks like the world is spinning the opposite direction than what you are actually spinning in, right? Because that endolymph now is flowing over the crista ampullaris in the other direction. Okay. So that's how that all kind of works. I don't think I have another slide. No, that's just hearing. So what I want you to know about the ear, we'll put in a nice table right here. Okay, so let's figure out what are the three senses for hearing. I mean for the ear, sorry. What are the three senses in the ear? Okay, so ear. E-A-R. All right, so we got hearing. Yeah, static, and I'm going to abbreviate it equilibrium, static equilibrium, and then what? Kinetic equilibrium. All right, and we got three main parts of the ear. What are the three main parts again? Yeah, that's a bony labyrinth, but overall, the part that you can see, sounds like you've got external, you got middle, and you got inner. Okay, which sense of these three requires an external ear? Hearing does. What about static equilibrium? No. You're right. It doesn't require an external ear. Your equilibrium is just fine, even if something happened to your external ear right here. Or if your external auditory meatus got plugged, it wouldn't matter. Right? So external is not necessary for either of these senses of equilibrium. What about middle ear? Is it important to have the right structures functioning properly for hearing?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So don't forget what those structures are. What about for equilibrium?
No.
Not required. And the inner ear. Do you need any part of the inner ear for hearing?
Yes.
Absolutely. What part is that?
Cochlea.
What about the static equilibrium?
Yes.
What part is that? Close. It's called the vestibule. All right. And then for kinetic equilibrium, do you need an inner ear?
Yes.
Absolutely. All right. So let's just make a note of what are the parts. So the parts we call, all right, the bony labyrinth. The bony labyrinth for hearing. What's the bony labyrinth for hearing? Looks like a snail. That's the cochlea. That's the cochlea. What about for static equilibrium?
Vestibule.
And for kinetic equilibrium, that's the, yeah, that's the semi-circular canals. All right, so that's kind of how I talked about it in lecture. Now, what about the organ? What organ is necessary? Okay, so I'm going to put, don't forget, nice break right here. The organ. Don't forget, there's an A in organ, too. Organ. Hearing, what's the organ? Inside the cochlea for hearing. That's called what? The organ of Corti. Organ of Corti. And you should kind of have a picture in your mind where that is. It's between the scala vestibuli, scala tympani. It's got that sectorial membrane in there, right? Okay, what about the organ for static equilibrium? You got two. They're both called maculae. Okay. And the two are called what? The utricle and saccule. Now, what's funny? What's funny about the utricle and saccule? It struck me as funny. I guess it didn't strike anybody else in here that's funny. Okay. But the utricle and saccule have those little crystals on them. Where are those crystals sitting? On the gelatinous mass? Right? Okay, so it has. That's the only place where I know where you have those nice kind of fancy crystals in your body. Okay, utricle and saccule, that's the maculae. What about the organ for kinetic equilibrium? Crista ampullaris. Yep, that's the organ. Now, oh, I need more board. What about the receptor cell? Receptor cell. The receptor cell for hearing. Hair cells. Are you kidding me? You're kidding me. No, you're right. It's those cells that have those stereocilia on them. Right? So, hair cell. But when I say hair, it's not like hair on your head, right?
No.
So you need a hair cell for hearing.
Yes,
you do. Okay. What's the receptor cell for static equilibrium? Now you're really pulling my leg. Is that true? It's the same cell? You know what? You're right. Another hair cell right over here. And then and this hair cell for kinetic equilibrium as well. All right? So through evolution, that same kind of cell has been adapted for various different kinds of senses. And is there anything similar between hearing and kinetic equilibrium? Like when somebody starts singing, does your head start spinning or anything like that? No, the senses are totally different, right? Totally, totally different, all right? The same receptor cell. So it's really the part of the brain that receives electrical information from these cells that gives you that particular sense, right? So even if you had hair cells somehow wired up to the occipital lobe, if you had hair cells generating action potentials, and somehow we were able to make it go to the occipital lobe, what would be the perception? What's the occipital lobe used for in terms of perception? That's going to be, yeah, somebody said vision, right? So you would hear things. No, I mean you'd see things, sorry. Okay, you would see things. So depending on, and, right, so these hair cells send signals to that temporal lobe for you to hear. That's where your primary auditory cortex is. We aren't talking about where the senses for equilibrium go. Okay, so that's it for the senses chapter. Okay, so make sure you got that table down straight in your mind. It's not too hard to appreciate. Okay, and of course those exam figures. Okay, so what chapter was that? 16? Okay. We don't need that anymore. All right, so let's move on to the heart. What chapter is that? Oh, good. I was hoping it wasn't 17. All right, so you guys have seen a bunch of hearts already in lab. Okay, so that's good. All right, I need to erase the board again. All right, so we're going to talk about the heart. How many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
How many valves does the heart have? Ooh, not quite so many people answered that one, but so... That's why it's really an easy question, because the number of valves in the heart equal the number of chambers. All right, so let's take a look at a heart, kind of quickly. All right, so most of this is anatomy that you have to know, right? So a heart kind of looks like that, right? And this pointy end down over here, what do we call a pointy end? That's the apex. So apex is here, and this is the base, right? So it's like a pyramid, but it's upside down because this is the superior part of the heart, this is the inferior part of the heart. And up to now, we saw a lot of symmetry, bilateral symmetry in the body. So if you have five fingers on one side of the body, what do you got on the other?
Same number.
Same number, right? If all goes well, you got five. If you've got a humerus on one side of the body, what do you got on the other? You got a humerus on the other side. This is the first time when we see a little asymmetry in the body, and you all probably know, where is the heart mostly located? Is it right smack in the middle? You all knew this back in grade school. Most of the heart is over on the left side of the body. Okay, now how does it end up like that? Well, as you go from base to apex, the base is pretty much right smack midline, but the heart is angulated. As you go from base to apex, so the palm of my hand is the base, the tip of my finger here is the apex. As you go from base to apex, it tilts to the left, like that. It's kind of slanted. So that's one way it's angulated, but it's angulated another way too. As you go from base to apex, it's angulated anteriorly as well. So it's doubly angulated, all right? And it's not symmetrically positioned inside your body. So the most anterior part of the heart is actually the apex, not the base. And when you're, what's the job of the heart? What does your heart do? It contracts, right? So it's pumping blood. And when that muscle contracts, it beats fairly violently inside somebody's chest. And it goes like that. So the apex is actually pounding upon the thoracic wall. And if you ever want to know where somebody's heart is, you can feel where the heart is because that apex is pounding up against the chest wall. And even on really thin people, you can even see that spot. Right, you can see their chest just kind of pounding out. That's called the point of maximal impulse, or PMI. And you can palpate that. It's going to be underneath the pectoralis muscle. So if you ever want to, and everybody's heart is in a little bit different position. If you ever want to know exactly where a patient's heart is located, you just palpate for that PMI. All right, so we said that the heart has four chambers, right? So does that look good? Yeah, really good. So the top two are what we call atria. All right, and the bottom two are what we call ventricles. And then we have a right side and a left side as well. So this heart is like looking at the heart that's inside me, facing you. So what side is this? What hand do I have raised? This is the left and this is the right side. So here's right and here's left. So we call this the RA. We call this the RV. Here is the LA, thank you, and this is the LV right here. Left ventricle, right ventricle. Okay. Okay, I'm close. I knew I was close. Okay. So this is, that's my anterior side right here. That's the anterior view. Okay. So I'll give you a really quick hint for lab. You're going to have to take a practicum on the heart. So when you see a heart laying in a dissection tray, what are the three things that you're immediately going to look at to find, okay, to get oriented? A lot of times you look at a heart and you go, oh, I knew the heart, but I'm looking at it. Now I can't make heads or tails out of it. How do you always start? Three simple things. You look at the apex. Is that easy to find? Yeah, from across the room. Base? All right, so now you know the top part, you know the inferior part, right? Superior, inferior part. You only need to know one other surface, one other side, to know everything about the heart, and that is, what is the anterior side? So there is a structure on the anterior part of the heart that, again, you can see from across the room if you know what to look for. There is a separation between the ventricles, and there's a depression on the surface of the heart. We call that a sulcus, is a depression. And there's usually a lot of pericardial fat in that depression, so the heart muscle is nice and dark, the fat is white or yellow, and this diagonal stripe is what we call the longitudinal. As a matter of fact, it's what? Anterior. Anterior longitudinal sulcus. All right, the anterior longitudinal sulcus. So those are things you can see from across the room. And once you know what the anterior side, top and bottom, you know which is left, which is right. Okay, and then the right ventricle is going to pump blood out of the pulmonary trunk. Right, and then you just start piecing things together automatically. So the most anterior vessel, great vessel coming off the base of the heart, is always going to be the pulmonary trunk. And it kind of looks like the aorta. It's a big, thick, highly elastic artery, but it's not the aorta. It's the pulmonary trunk, most anterior vessel. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. And the aorta is going to be posterior to it. All right? Well, I'll show you some pictures. All right, let's get back to this other diagram here. What's the function of a valve? It stops backflow of blood because blood should flow through the heart in one direction. It shouldn't go backwards. The heart shouldn't pump blood, expend all that energy making blood go in one direction just to have it go backwards. And if that does happen, there are heart defects where that does happen that will kill the heart. And of course, who can live without a heart? Nobody. That kills the patient, right? So we're very interested in valves. So how many valves do we have again?
Four.
Ooh, that's pretty weak. Everybody should say
four.
Okay, so where are they? Let's look at blood flow. Blood flow comes back to the heart from one circulation called the systemic circulation to the right atrium. The other blood comes back to the heart from the lungs to the left atrium. The left atrium are going to pump blood into the ventricles right here. And so there's got to be a way to get from an atrium into a ventricle. Here's a way. But the ventricles contract with a lot of force. And it would shoot blood back up into the atria. But that should not happen, so there are valves here and here. Valves between atrium and ventricle are called, generally speaking, atrioventricular valves. Okay, atrioventricular valves, they have similar structure, mostly similar. But they have different names because there's a little bit of difference. This one over here on the right side has actually three flaps. And I don't know how to draw it, so I'll just put a little line right there. And this one over here has two flaps. So this one right here is called the tricuspid, what? If you want to be really serious, the atrioventricular valve. And this is, it has only two flaps, bicuspid. Yeah, and that's an atrioventricular valve as well. Bicuspid goes by another name because somebody had an idea to make a real fancy hat at one time that had these two parts to it, and then you can kind of fold it open like that and put it on your head. What's that called? That's called a mitre, or those little funny hats that you wear at graduation. They're like a tabletop you put on your head. That's a mitre, too. All right, but we're talking about one that had these two flaps, and it's worn by like luminaries in various religious organizations. Like the Pope wears this thing. And cardinals, that's called a mitre. So that kind of reminded somebody of a mitre. So this is called a mitral valve as well. You can use either one of these. People use them interchangeably. Just like what? Auditory tube, eustachian tube, and pharyngotympanic tube. Okay. All right, so blood flows in this direction, and when the ventricles when the ventricles contract, blood tries to go back. But then it does what? It pushes on the valves. We call these leaflets or cusps. And they slam closed. They go bam. They just come together. And it makes it's a pretty violent reaction. It makes a lot of noise in there. So you can listen for those things. All right, so here are two valves. Both of those, so you got two atrioventricular valves. Let's talk about these vessels once again. You have great vessels attached to the base of the heart, but if I were to draw a couple other vessels up there, it'd get really complicated. So I'm going to draw a couple other vessels down over here that take blood away from the heart in this direction. You see one is leaving from the LV, the other from the RV. And We need to start naming some of these vessels now. Okay, but let's define what an artery is and what a vein is. Oh, the projector went. That's why what happened. I got dark in here all of a sudden. Okay. What is an artery? What? It carries blood away from the heart. Does not matter what's in that blood. Could be oxygenated or deoxygenated blood. As long as it's carrying blood away, that's an artery. And a vessel bringing blood back to the heart is called a vein. So these up over here are veins. These down here are arteries. This one here is the aorta. And this one over here is going to the lungs, so we call this the pulmonary. Pulmonary, and you could call it artery, but this one here is kind of special. We call it the pulmonary trunk because it's going to bifurcate very quickly into the right and left pulmonary arteries. These up over here now are veins. This one has a special kind of name. This is the superior vena cava. And this is the inferior vena cava, or sometimes we just say IVC, and this is sometimes we call this SVC. And that just the VC just stands for a cavernous vein. That's what it really stands for. So these are big, huge veins. These over here are coming back from the lungs. So these are what we call the pulmonary. Anytime you see pulmonary, you should think of lungs or having something to do with ventilation or breathing. Pulmonary veins. Right. Okay. So the ventricles, the heart is pumping blood, not like an electric motor. If you have an electric pump, it's pumping all the time, right? Because it's just spinning. But your heart doesn't pump blood all the time. Sometimes it has to relax. So we call that a part of the heart cycle. Sometimes the heart is pumping, sometimes it's relaxing. And for decades and decades, when people were interested in studying the heart, they looked at the function of the heart during contraction. They thought that was the most important. All right, but now we know better, because in order for the heart to pump blood, what has to happen? It has to relax and it's got to fill. Right? So it's just as important that the heart fills with blood before it pumps, otherwise you're going to have problems. So those two parts of the heart cycle are called systole and diastole. Systole is contraction. Diastole is relaxation. And both have play important roles in the circulatory system. Okay. So during diastole, that's when the ventricles relax, right? There is high pressure in these arteries. There's low pressure in the ventricles, right? When the ventricles relax or during diastole. So which way is blood going to want to flow? All right, but let's just consider for a second some basic physics, and that is when you have fluid like air in a room or something, all right, or fluid in a pipe, it will only flow when what happens? There is a pressure difference. So how will a fluid flow? From low pressure to high pressure or high pressure to low? Yeah, from high pressure to low. So if your tire in your car needs air, you have to get something that has higher pressure to put air into the tire, right? So when the ventricles relax, it's low pressure, it's high pressure in these arteries. Which way is blood going to flow? Back from an artery into the ventricle, and that's eventually going to kill the person because that's backward. It shouldn't flow backwards. So guess what? There are valves here as well, here and here. They're not atrioventricular valves. They don't look anything like an AV valve. They're called semilunar valves. Both are semilunar, but this one is what? The aortic semilunar, this is the pulmonary semilunar valve. Okay, and the semilunar valves have three cusps. So if we look at the orifice of the aorta right here, the entrance to the aorta looking from the inside, right, the cusps kind of look like that. Right, and then they slam closed when the ventricles relax. All right, so how many chambers you got? Four. How many valves you got? You got to know the valves. How are you going to remember this is the tricuspid and this is the bicuspid over here? Unless you have really good photographic memory. The little trick is what? Yeah, try before you buy. Okay, so the tricuspid is on the Okay, on the right side of the heart, and the bicuspid's on the left side of the heart. Okay. All right, so that's a lot about the heart. Some things about the heart. Let's look at some not-so-good figures. What are some not-so-good figures? Here's one in the book. Okay, nicely color-coded. Well, we see the four chambers, right atrium, left atrium, right ventricle, left ventricle. The structure between the chambers are what we call septa, right? So I have the cursor on the interventricular septum. There is an interatrial septum up over here that we can't see very well. All right, and on this slide, we see that there are two circulations in the body. One we're very familiar with, one we're not so familiar with. The one that we are familiar with is what we call the systemic circulation. And the systemic circulation goes to almost every place in your body. And it's the left ventricle that pumps blood into the aorta, and from the aorta that feeds what? Your head, your trunk, your upper appendages, abdominal pelvic cavity, lower appendages. And it's bringing oxygen to these tissues so that you can manufacture energy molecules in the name of ATP. We need oxygen, and so these vessels here, we are color-coding them red because it's carrying oxygen. And it kind of looks red in real life as well, so I'm told. Yeah.
Could you say the left side carries most of the oxygenated blood?
Let me continue with that.
Yeah,
I think you're really close. Just a little modification is necessary. All right, so here is a blood vessel taking blood away from the heart, so that is generally an artery. Yeah, so here is an artery carrying oxygenated blood, and in the tissues there's special little blood vessels called capillaries, and capillaries allow for exchange. Oxygen leaves, and then it picks up a waste product of metabolism called carbon dioxide. All right, so this blood is relatively deoxygenated. It still contains oxygen, a lot of oxygen, but it's relatively deoxygenated compared to this artery right here. So we give it kind of a blue color, right? And it comes back through what, the superior and inferior vena cava to the right atrium, past the tricuspid valve into the right ventricle. The right ventricle's job is to pump this deoxygenated blood to the lungs. It does so via the pulmonary circulation. So here is the pulmonary circulation going to the lungs. There are capillaries in the lungs that release CO2 and absorb oxygen. All right, so here is what, an artery or a vein? It's an artery. Because why? It's taking blood away from the heart. But how come it's colored blue? Is that strange? It's deoxygenated blood because the pulmonary circulation is opposite compared to the systemic circulation, right? So even though it's an artery, it's carrying deoxygenated blood, and obviously that makes sense because it's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen and to release carbon dioxide. So again, the capillaries for exchange, oxygenated blood comes back to the left side of the heart. So is this an artery or a vein? It's a vein, even though it carries oxygenated blood. Absolutely, because it's the pulmonary vein. The pulmonary vein is oxygenated, all right, coming back to the left atrium. So you see the systemic circulation versus the pulmonary circulation. And make sure you can name all these valves that you see right here. Like, what's this valve right here? That's the aortic semilunar valve, right? That's right at the orifice or the opening to the aorta, coming from the left ventricle. All right, so make sure you got artery and vein clearly defined in your mind and know how the circulation kind of switches function between the pulmonary and systemic circulation. Okay, so this is a pretty good figure. Here we see the heart, the nice angulation, doubly angulated heart. Don't forget the apex of the heart moves anteriorly as well, which we can't see on this diagram too much. Okay, so here is... Let's look at a slice through the heart. So let's look at some layers of the heart. So this is just a transmural cut through the heart. So this is the inside of the chamber. This is outside of the heart. And so this chamber, what chamber is this right here? Left atrium. So this is left atrium in this region right here. All right, so let's start with the innermost layer. The innermost layer is what we call the endocardium. And the endocardium is very smooth and slippery. And that's because blood is flowing over it. If it was ragged or jagged or very rough, that would cause blood to clot. And you don't want your heart causing blood, generating blood clots, because that's going to go into a blood vessel and plug that blood vessel up, and it's going to kill that part of the body that that blood vessel is feeding, right? If it's in your brain, that's going to cause a stroke. If it's going to the heart, then that's going to cause a heart attack. So the endocardium is very special. It's smooth and slippery. It's not very thick, but that prevents blood clots from being generated by the heart. The next layer is the thickest layer. We call that the myocardium. That's the contractile part of the heart. And then there is another layer right on the surface of the heart. We call that the epicardium. All right, so the heart has three main layers. From superficial to deep, they are epi, myo, and endo. Okay. The epicardium makes up part of the serous membrane of the heart. And you're going to have to go back to maybe the first chapter to remember something about a serous membrane as opposed to a mucous membrane. The serous membrane lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world. And so the heart is in the pericardial cavity, which is inside the pericardial cavity is inside, what's the next biggest cavity in the, is close. Okay, close. Maybe I'll go back. Yes. Okay. So this cavity right here is the mediastinum. It separates, right, the right and left pleural cavities. All right, so you got the pericardial cavity within the mediastinum, and then you got the pleural cavities over here. And if we take the pleural cavities and the mediastinum, that makes up the thoracic cavity. Right. So there are a number of cavities that can be used to make up a cavity. But anyway, the pericardial cavity has a serous membrane. And a serous membrane has got three parts to it. There is the parietal division, there is the visceral division, and then the space between those two membranes. So the visceral layer is what? The serous membrane that's right on the surface of that organ. And since this is the heart, right, this is also the epicardium. So the epicardium and the visceral layer of the serous pericardium are exactly the same thing. And here is the pericardial cavity, and then here is the parietal layer of that serous membrane. Notice that it's continuous, right? And then there's a special layer of connective tissue that we call the fibrous pericardium. Just like this is analogous to the thickest, toughest layer of the meninges. What is the thickest, toughest layer of the meninges called? Oh, this is good for a week from today. The dura mater. And you maybe ran into that in lab already. If you had to take the dura mater off of a brain, that was tedious because it's what? Really tough. And you start taking it off and everything rips apart because it's really, really tough. Well, the fibrous pericardium is just as tough as well. And the fibrous pericardium suspends the heart within the pericardial cavity, allows the heart to move around, but still stay in position, just like the dura mater does. Okay, this pericardial cavity shouldn't ever have a viral infection or bacterial infection, just like the cerebral spinal fluid should never have an infection, but it can, or there could be an inflammation to the pericardial cavity and the space right here, maybe after surgery or something. And fluid builds up in the pericardial cavity, and do you think that's a serious situation? Yes. What do we call that? Pericarditis or pericardial effusion, because when this fills up with fluid, it gets really, really wide, right? And when this space gets wide, guess what happens to the heart? It compresses the heart. And remember we said the heart not only contracts, but it also has to fill. Yeah, it has to relax during diastole. And if this space is filled with fluid, the heart relaxes, but it can't expand. The heart doesn't fill up with blood. And of course, when the heart contracts, it doesn't pump any blood, and that doesn't do anybody any good when that happens. Right? So that has to be dealt with antibiotics, but more acutely, you just stick a needle in here and then aspirate some of that fluid out. And people feel better almost immediately as a result of that. All right, so here are the transmural layers as well as what the serous pericardium that you should be aware of. Let's take a look at my notes right here. And I think we talked about all this stuff. Valves, all that good stuff, the transmural layers, blood flow through the heart. Okay. Okay, let me look at a slide, next couple slides. Right here. Here's that anterior longitudinal sulcus on the anterior part of the heart. This is really handy because if we look at the posterior side of the heart, which is right here, we find some sulci on the posterior side of the heart, but if this is the sulcus between the atria and ventricles right here at the base of the heart, these sulci on the posterior side go what? Straight down toward the apex. They are not angulated. But if we look at the anterior longitudinal sulcus, notice that it is angulated. So it's really easy to see the anterior longitudinal sulcus. So for the heart, let's just look at some of these structures. I don't think this is an exam figure, but it's close. Okay. Notice the inferior vena cava, superior vena cava, taking blood to the right atrium. Right. So here is the right ventricle. Right ventricle pumps blood into the pulmonary trunk, which then bifurcates very early on to right and left pulmonary arteries. And blood comes back through the pulmonary veins. You can see it's oxygenated through the veins into the left atrium, pumping blood into the left ventricle. Left ventricle pumps blood into the aorta. And here we have a couple branches. This is really what I wanted to use on this particular slide. Branches off the aorta. The first branch on the arch of the aorta is the brachiocephalic. This is taking blood to the right side of the head and the right upper appendage. And then you have the left common carotid taking blood to the left side of the head and the left subclavian taking blood to the left upper appendage. So here we see, we don't see a perfect symmetry either associated with the heart. But remember that the what does brachiocephalic really mean? Brachio means arm. Cephalic means toward the head or brain. So the brachiocephalic is doing the job of the left common carotid and the left subclavian on the right side of the body. Right? And as a matter of fact, some people, we might see that these two are kind of fused and actually looks like a left brachiocephalic, but it really isn't. All right. Okay, so now the brachiocephalic is not the first branch off the aorta. And when I say branch, I mean an artery coming off the aorta feeding a part of the body. The first branches off the aorta actually come from the ascending aorta right here, because even though there is a lot of blood inside the heart, inside the chambers, that can't nourish the myocardium itself, right? The middle layer that's contracting, that's using a lot of energy. So it needs its own blood supply, and it gets blood through some special arteries that feed the heart. What do we call the arteries that feed the heart? I'm not sure you had to know that in lab, but they're coronary arteries. And there are two. There is a left and a right. So right within the valve cusps, there are orifices or openings for the right coronary artery and the left coronary. We can't see them originating from the aorta, but they're on the ascending aorta as opposed to the arch. Okay, and then the aorta starts to descend through the body. So that would be called the descending aorta. And when it's in the thoracic cavity, we call it the thoracic descending. When it goes through the diaphragm into the abdominal region, we would call that the abdominal aorta. That's descending. Okay. All right, let's see if I can find that fibrous skeleton someplace. There is a fibrous skeleton, right here, between the atria and the ventricles. So there isn't muscle between the atria and ventricles, so we have a nice superior view of the heart. This is connective tissue. And within that connective tissue, we find the rings of all four valves sewn into the fibrous skeleton. And that's really handy because, for instance, if we ever need to replace a valve, I guess it's relatively easy to sew another valve right into this fibrous skeleton. So it stabilizes the valves in the normal circumstance, and then if a valve ever needs to be replaced, it acts as a nice structure to sew those valves into. Okay, it has another importance, and that is that electrical signals can travel through the myocardium, which is the muscle part of the heart, very easily. It can go from one muscle cell to another, but electrical signals can't make it through this connective tissue right here. So the atria are isolated electrically from the ventricles because of the fibrous skeleton. So when we get to the conduction system of the heart, that will make some sense for you. So don't forget about this fibrous skeleton. Now, I did see a really nice exam figure. This is it right here. All right, so I'm sure you're familiar with this from lab already. But we got what? The base of the heart. We got the apex right here, interventricular septum, interatrial septum. And you're familiar with the valves, like on the right side, atrioventricular valve on the right side is the tricusp, tri before you, bi over here. Here's the nice pulmonary semilunar valve, aortic semilunar valve over here. And we see some other fine structures. In the ventricles, these muscles, this lattice work of muscles, we call trabeculae carni. These aid in contraction. There are some other muscles inside the ventricles that look more like fingertips. We call those papillary muscles. Now, how can you always tell a papillary muscle apart from a trabeculae? Because a papillary muscle has something else attached to it, a chordae tendine. Right, so here you see a nice papillary muscle, and you see some nice fine tendons right here that go between a papillary muscle and a leaflet of an AV valve. And the chordae tendine and the papillary muscles prevent the AV valves from inverting. Because if they were to invert, then they would be insufficient or incompetent. That means that they would leak, and that would kill the heart. Right, so the papillary muscles have to function to maintain the function of the AV valves. We see some other little muscles in atria, mostly in the right atrium, but you can find them in the left atrium as well. They look like trabeculae carni, but we don't call them trabeculae. We call them pectinate muscles, right? So pectinate are in the atria, trabeculae are in the ventricles. Okay, one last thing I want to show you. So this, you got to know all the different parts of this. We're going to come back to the fossa ovalis a little bit later next time, but I do want to show you, okay, something over here. All right, so we said that the coronary arteries feed blood to the heart itself, to the myocardium. Well, blood also has to then return to the right atrium right here with the rest of the systemic circulation. So there's a big, huge vein that's returning blood from the heart to the right atrium, and that thing is this right here. That's called the coronary sinus. And it's a big, huge vein on the, and is this anterior or posterior side of the heart? Posterior, because you see these are just going straight down, nice and perpendicular. So this is the posterior side of the heart, and you can find it from the right atrium right here. And you should probably put a nice probe when you're ever in lab. Stick a probe into the coronary sinus. It slips right in very nicely because the orifice or the opening for that coronary sinus is huge. It's a big, huge vein. So again, when we say sinus, you have to know where it is. Sometimes a sinus has air in it. Give me an example of a structure of a sinus. Give me the name of a sinus that has air. Like a paranasal sinus. Okay, this particular sinus has blood. Okay, so just because it's a sinus, you can't tell what's always in. You have to know what part of the body it's in. All right, so maybe we're going to try and finish up. Well, we got to finish up heart next time and circulation. So review these chapters, learn some vocabulary so that the last lecture before the test makes a lot of sense to you. Okay? I'm going to turn off my microphone.